Hello, my name is Daniel Nenni, founder of SemiWiki, the open forum for semiconductor professionals. Welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. If you have a topic you'd like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Sagar Pushpala, a seasoned semiconductor professional with more than 35 years of experience with IDMs, fabless, and related semiconductor entities. He's actively involved with nearly a dozen companies in the U.S., Singapore, and India in advisory, board, consulting, and investment roles. Welcome to the podcast, Sagar.
Thank you, Daniel. Happy to be here.
First, please share with us how you originally came to the semiconductor industry and what brought you to where you are today.
Yeah, let me start with some background. After completing my undergraduate degree in chemical engineering in India, I came to the U.S. for my graduate degree, also in chemical engineering, with a stint or a graduation effort towards petroleum engineering. AMD hired me as a process engineer after my graduate degree. And in those days, there were not many roles in chemical engineering or in petroleum engineering. So there were very few programs in microelectronics, teaching and getting engineers equipped to be process engineers. So the natural choice was to be either in chemical engineering or material science. And these were ideal process engineers in fab. So, and for context, in those days in the Bay Area in the early 80s, we had nearly 25 or 30 wafer fabs in the Bay Area as opposed to none today, right? So my early career was in process engineering at a few fabs in the Bay Area. We could move around every few years and find the right opportunities. And over the next few years, many of the fabs here began to shut down and move out of the Bay Area, maybe to Austin and other locations, where both costs and infrastructure incentives were actually growing quite a bit in the Bay Area. But then I was attracted to the analog side of the world, where the design and technology operations are tied much closer together, as the framework or fabric for digital technologies was not as evident in analog. So the companies like National Semiconductor, Maxim, Intersil, were some of the analog companies I did some tours with. And towards the late 80s is when the foundry model or the fabless model of fabless companies started to come into existence. And then they started to evolve. And as foundries emerged, the nodes shifting from 180 to 130 to 90 to 65 started to occur. And they were mostly digital focused, and they were following the Moore's law as we know it. And as digital technologies started to get into foundries, the older factories had to be utilized for the analog mixed signal nodes, where you can add more voltages, more device options, more RF options. And then as many fab and fabless companies started to see the value of working with foundries on both advanced logic and on analog mixed signal depreciated fabs. So began the analog foundry world, where the initial engagements were with tier two foundries, where the technology was what I call a phase in or a process transfer from an IDM to a foundry occurred. And of course, eventually the foundries became quite savvy and hired their own analog talent. So my journey through most of these analog companies later on in the 2000 plus to 2020 timeframe was mostly transitioning the shift from an IDM to an asset-light model. And that was quite evident in how some of these companies started to work in the industry. So after stints at analog companies, I eventually ended up in a corporate role where I ran all of technology and operations. And once I got to that spot, I decided, hey, I should get back to my roots. So I pivoted away from operations and I pursued many startups that eventually led me to a venture capital firm where the hardware investments were in focus. And I got to work with many chip and system companies, many of them thriving businesses today. And some of them went through acquisitions. Of course, some of them folded. I then took a short stint at running a boutique foundry. And after I got my exit, TSMC tapped me to come run their specialty technologies business development effort. So, as I said, I kind of got away from operations and fabs and got it to more on the business development side. I eventually left TSMC to join a startup co-founded by one of TSMC's top customers. However, I wanted this role to be a little different. I'd longed to work on bleeding edge technologies, and as my background would show, I've spent most of my time in what they call specialty or analog mixed signal kind of technologies. So I actually took on a role on the bleeding edge and an area that I wasn't exposed to before. And within a couple of years, that startup, for good reason, was acquired by Qualcomm. And I spent my customary time at Qualcomm before departing. I'm now independent. I have no corporate operating role affiliation. And so that's kind of where things are. Throughout my career, leadership career, I was fortunate to be involved in many startups and advisory and board roles, both in the US, India, and in Singapore. I continue to enjoy that passion in my semi-retirement and meeting brilliant entrepreneurs in the process of helping startups scale. I joined the advisor network at a few incubators, including Silicon Catalyst, where I get to see fun ideas and meet great people. So I like to spend about 30 to 40% of my time advising, investing, and consulting with companies, and travel as much as I can the rest of the time. So I hope that gets you some perspective about my background.
Yeah, that's a great history. It's not unlike mine. I started in the early 80s in a fab in Silicon Valley, in Sunnyvale, actually. So let's talk about current events, and then we can get your views on the overall semiconductor manufacturing landscape. How would you describe the CHIPS Act actions towards the future of U.S. manufacturing and the infrastructure?
Really, very current topic, Daniel. Well, let me see where to start. Let me just say, U.S. is trying to take control. I'm afraid maybe too little too late. So that's the kind of general theme, so we have some perspective in mind. Overall, absolutely yes. U.S. needs to be self-sufficient and in control of their destiny as much as they can in other areas as well, and semiconductors is no different. The CHIPS Act, however, is attracting a lot of big companies to get either funding to stay onshore or come back onshore. And the monies may not be enough to sustain for the long term. That's my worry. And some of these companies, although, have announced 10, 20-year plans. So this overextension, to me, does not appear real. And I wish that would be true and sustained for the long term. The infrastructure costs, the labor costs, and the factory discipline efficiencies, as opposed to what happens overseas in Asia, needs to be modeled and understood in the U.S., and that hasn't happened for a long term, except for Intel and the perhaps Global Foundries and some of the analog companies. There are very few advanced logic factories in the U.S. So in addition, the U.S. needs to fund semiconductor equipment capabilities. Specifically, I'll come back to it, a lithography tool, an alternate to ASML. ASML is just a single source monopoly today, and that's a worry. And they also have to fund capabilities both in fab as well as packaging. And more importantly, we also need to develop a stellar national lab network to create and do fundamental research, just like an IMEC or LETI in Europe. I think the U.S. Badly needs that. So we ensure and remain competitive onshore. Well, the economy is not hot. The fears of inflation, recession, pre-announcements, revenue adjustments, slowdown of factory bills, CapEx pullbacks, layoffs, all of these are clouding our current thinking. So we should expect some of this to last through most of 23, and hopefully 2024 is when things will start to pick up again. So let's brace ourselves and let the CHIPS Act funding not get impacted, because there is no better time to invest than in a slowdown, in my opinion. Well, the China sanctions, as we all know, those things will have supply chain disruption impact, as you know. And many companies today, fabulous companies, use China foundries and OSATs, as well as supply into the China market. So bringing that manufacturing out of China and blocking equipment into China will be expensive. Job dislocation and supply chain realignment and cost increases were all some of the things we will get to experience. And I would say, if you bring manufacturing back to the U.S. and for the expensive gadgets, could be much more expensive for us. What we think of today, a mobile phone that is $1,200 to $1,400 would be north of $2,000 by the time we actually get products built here and set things up. The Russia-Ukraine war and associated distractions, not significant supply chain, but there are some rare gases and materials that come out of there, and that would see some impact as well. But let me attempt to comment on the overall state of manufacturing. I think there's tightness in demand that appears to be easing on some of the older nodes. And except for the most advanced nodes, sub 7 nanometer, most capacity should ease up in 2023. And that would be my overall summary, Daniel.
That's a good summary. I agree. So what is your perspective on Intel and their recent internal reorganization around a dedicated foundry for internal products and external fabless customers? This is a big topic right now, actually.
Absolutely. It's very current as well. And it's evolving every week. And we'll probably know more in the next few weeks when their announcement comes out. But Intel appears to be, at least to me, in a state of confusion. There are many, many darts being thrown. And so some of them may stick, but the strategy still seems unclear. The drop market share, the revenues have dropped, and gross margins have dropped from a baseline of 60% to 36%. And the technology appears clearly to be behind the likes of TSMC and Samsung by at least a generation, if not more. So Intel's shortcomings, to me, in my mind, are the combination of the x86 architecture limitations. Remember, this architecture has been around for 20 years, and there's certain big blocks in that architecture that are likely untouched. And of course, the technology readiness that goes with their factories. So treating their internal design group like a customer, I think it's the first step, but it's not enough. Intel needs leadership to run autonomously like a foundry. They need the foundry to be run completely independent with all the R&D, the IP collateral, the customer focus, the packaging, and of course the attitude to run like a foundry to support it. This I worry, as they haven't been able to demonstrate it after their Intel 2.0 state, and now it's literally an Intel 3.0 foundry that they have to go through. And to add to that, offering such a what I call an x86 optimized technology as a foundry may be suboptimal for other customers. So also a Tower Jazz acquisition seems to be a subpar. It seems to be unlikely to move the needle, as they're not clearly a tier one foundry. They have not have advanced node 60. They've just licensed a 65 nanometer technology and developed it in their Japan factory. But I don't think they are anywhere close to being in top three foundries. So, and of course, dipping into the tens of billions of the CHIPS Act dollars for the U.S. factories. And they're turning around and saying, hey, you know, we got to do, you know, many thousands of layoffs and restructuring amidst all this patience to preserve jobs. And the rationale seems a little confusing there as well. So in my opinion, Intel, I think, should acquire an entity like a GlobalFoundries where the overlap is zero, and where GlobalFoundries ends their node around the 12 to 14 nanometers. And Global has a geographic presence, U.S., Europe, Asia, and has a scale, and more importantly, a management team that is very foundry-centric. And this would be a great opportunity to have both these entities come together and perhaps spin out that entity as a standalone foundry. And so that would really strengthen U.S. presence as a technology foundry and packaging powerhouse. Hope that helps.
Yeah, I definitely agree GlobalFoundries should be acquired. I think either Samsung or Intel, you know, would be good homes. GlobalFoundries worked with Samsung on 14 nanometer. In fact, GlobalFoundries 14 nanometer is Samsung. So I thought that would be a fit. But yeah, they definitely have to be acquired. But so what is the state of the world in semiconductor manufacturing and supply chain from your perspective?
Well, I'll comment on the big movers, Daniel. Except for Intel, the advanced logic, and Samsung, the advanced logic memory and systems to some level, being IDMs leading the drive, the leading edge. Other fabless players like Qualcomm, Broadcom, NVIDIA, now AMD, and MediaTek, use multiple foundries. So even Intel is, I think, among the top 10 customers at TSMC. Go figure that. But Samsung, SK Hynix, and Micron round up the top three memory guys, as you know. They make up 95% of the memory production and usage. And they tend to have a global presence and typically are driven by market cycle. Micron, Samsung, and likely SK Hynix are investing heavily in the U.S. as well. So I think that's the memory piece. And I'm not as worried about that piece. I think we have a pretty decent handle on it. The analog mixed signal, or the analog side, has a split. The likes of TI, ADI, Infineon, NXP, ST have both their internal fabs, and they use foundries for both mature and advanced nodes. So TI has clearly indicated expansion of their manufacturing presence in the U.S. So that will bring some of the specialty technologies back and keep on 300 millimeters in the U.S. too. So the wide bandgap companies tend to be the IDMs for the most part, the GaN, the silicon carbide, some of those technologies. And the designs are very tight to technologies. And therefore, you need that to gain the performance benefit. So boutique foundries happen to just come up, but they do not have scale to play here. Although TSMC has GaN, a GaN offering. Silicon carbide, with their applications in high voltage and power and EV, is being now accepted widely. Even Global Foundries has announced funding to enhance their Vermont facility for GaN capability. So there will be more such efforts, but needs to be seen. So that's also a good first step in that area. However, U.S. needs a strong OSAT presence. We're missing that. You know, we can always rely on Asia and costs, but advanced packaging, we still depend on Asia. I think we need to have an advanced packaging effort as a standalone entity or as part of a foundry offering in the U.S. And when I mentioned the Intel and Global Foundries coming together, that would offer that opportunity. Lam, and getting into the equipment side, Applied and Lam seem to be stable with their offerings. They will see some short-term pullback due to the recession and a slowdown, but they could come back up pretty strong. My concern is ASML. They have a monopoly in EUV, and there's no second. Although Canon and Nikon still have presence in the non-cutting-edge photography tools. When I say non-cutting-edge, non-EUV. I think the world needs another source of EUV tools, and it, of course, cannot be in China, although China is trying to develop some of these capabilities today. So maybe some of the CHIPS Act money should go towards funding such sources, either in the U.S. or partnering with the Japanese. So I think it's important to have an alternate. Chinese equipment manufacturers appear to be self-sufficient across some areas, not across all. But having said that, the U.S. issued sanctions that suspend sales from all worldwide equipment suppliers to Chinese fabs is a huge blow. We'll see how that plays out, but this will clearly be disrupting supply chains across many product deliveries. So I'll comment on my views and tweaks later as we go along, but those are my thoughts as of now. Thank you.
Yeah, can you expand a little bit on logic, memory, analog mixed signal, wide band gap, and equipment supplier areas? I think that'd be useful.
Okay. Well, as we know, 75% of the advanced logic manufacturing from fabless players goes to TSMC. That's a monopoly in itself. They go to TSMC. And 65% of TSMC's revenues come from less than 28 nanometer nodes, right? And TSMC's 28 nanometer and larger node revenues is about $28 billion. People don't realize that. It's a pretty huge number in itself. It's larger than the next four foundries' revenues put together. So that's how TSMC's non-advanced revenues are as well. So UMC and Global Foundries are trying to capture their own market space while the demand is hot and expanding into their, what I call them, to the 12 nanometer nodes. I think most of them are cutting at that kind of node. Samsung continues to focus on less than 14 nanometer nodes. The foundries have increased prices during the supply chain crunch, and that's the, I think it's a first recognition that during the COVID and the supply chain crunch, folks have found ways to increase wafer prices to keep up with the increasing costs. But interestingly, if you notice below that, their margins have improved to historic levels, or should I say record levels during COVID. If you look at UMC, UMC's margins went from 17% to 42%. Global Foundries, of course, after they went IPO, went from nearly zero to 22% margins, gross margins. And of course, TSMC is sitting close to 59 or 60% gross margins. And I'll throw in ASML here for fun. ASML went from 45% gross margins to 51% gross margins. So you really wonder, are these cost increases effective? Are they reasonable? Are they rational? Right. So will these trends reverse when things slow down? Or is this a new paradigm where foundries can increase wafer prices when they can? So here's my magic wand. I think I touched on this before. With Intel's focus on greater than 10 nanometer nodes, or I should say less than 10 nanometer nodes, and with their packaging prowess, could reap benefits if they acquired GlobalFoundries and built out a broad offering of technologies, all the way from the advanced 5 and 7 nanometers down to 180, 250 nanometers. This collective, and of course, packaging as well, and this collective R&D and operation entity should spin out and be standalone. This way, Intel can decide to go to that foundry, call it the Intel plus GF, or they can go to Samsung, or they can go to TSMC, and they can get their product and architecture story back in line again. Ditto for TSMC. TSMC should focus on getting into 300 millimeters on their mature nodes. Today, they're mostly on, when I say mature, the 180, 150, 130, where that world is still quite active. And there's a lot of, literally millions and millions of wafers still being produced on that. And they're, in a way, they're constrained and not building any more 200 millimeter fabs. Samsung, I think, should acquire UMC for the same reason. They have the advanced technologies and they have packaging, and they can get the breadth of the mature nodes from UMC. Then collectively we'd have three thriving foundries and advanced packaging units: TSMC, Global, and Intel, UMC, and Samsung. That's the story for the day.
So any words of wisdom for possible improvements there?
There is improvements. I think during this recessionary period, I think all these thoughts will come together. The Intel and GF story, I think, is important, and the Samsung and UMC story has to come together. I think when we look at where things are today, they're just going to go on the same course, except focus on getting manufacturing back into the U.S. That's only a small piece of the whole puzzle. So.
Can you comment on how we should view the rest of the world with respect to their chip manufacturing strategies?
Well, we've talked enough about China. So over the next 6 to 9 months, we would have a reasonable understanding of how the U.S. imposed sanctions will play out. Will that be very disruptive to our economy and the Chinese economy, but more importantly, to the U.S. supply chain? With a chip slowdown coming, this may be a blessing in disguise in terms of time, I think. So I think U.S. should ensure Taiwan and South Korea remain stable, both structurally and politically, to support their thriving semiconductor ecosystem. I think that's important. We got to figure how Washington plays into that, right? So Japan and EU will naturally strengthen their presence locally and support U.S. They will not lead conversations with or about China. I think they will support U.S. And with over 100 new electric vehicles models coming out in the next 2-3 years, automotive electronics and chip content will likely double and drive the next uptick. That's my thinking as to how we come out of this. India is very different and an emerging story, and will likely be the third largest economy, as most people would say, within the next decade. With their already thriving and efficient semiconductor product design, the engineering talent pool there is tremendous. One could argue that a natural extension of that capability is what I call product definition, where they define new products, because India today is not stellar in defining products. They're very good in engineering the execution side. So product definition via setting up incubators and driving programs there, and as well as perhaps looking at some mature early stage manufacturing. You can see from the recent press releases on this front, 50% incentives are being offered to qualified fab and technology operators in India. However, I think India is not moving fast enough. They're just caught up in such politics about who should be funded and who not. Hope some of those issues will come through and take care of in the next few months. The China fear and supply chain shortage is driving some of this in India. However, the latter could be a moot point, because the supply chain shortage creating with the China sanctions could come as a surprise. So that'll be another interesting point to go see how it plays out in India. There is an argument to be made. So India could be a fertile ground for manufacturing. I think they should focus on PCBs modules, packaging, and then extending to what I call non-leading edge foundry capabilities. I'm talking about capabilities in the 180 to perhaps 40 nanometers, maybe 20, 28 nanometers. And this will have to occur via a very strong business plan that really calls for doing this kind of business and driving technologies and manufacturing. So I think it has to be a three-way collaboration for India. A large India conglomerate like a Tata's or a Reliance or a Adani has to be at the core of this. And then you have a tier one foundry licensing their mature technologies. So it's going to be foundry compatible model in India. If India is going to go off and develop their own capabilities, it'll take them a good 10, 15 years before they can get there. So licensing, having foundries license their technologies into India, and of course having a strong operating team, India build a strong operating team to go run that. So that may be a good way to get the focus away from China and have India where the strategically, you know, it's an IP safe nation and with immense engineering talent and to have an alternate low cost location. So hope that helps.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think India is the next big growth area. I think that's the next big story for the semiconductor ecosystem. India is actually the second largest reader of SemiWiki, second to the United States. So there's huge amount of activity. So I'm following that quite closely, and I see that as the big next story. So finally, can you comment on the many chip cycles we have seen together through our careers? Do you have a sense of the current semiconductor slump, recession fears, recovery, and what that timing could look like? Do you have a brief summary on this?
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll keep it simple. I don't know the real answer. If I knew, I wouldn't be on this podcast. So, however, in my opinion, three macro moves can affect the recovery. I think an off-ramp for Russia and their war with Ukraine, I really mean that, could provide a semblance of the recession stalling. The interest rates probably reversing a bit, and a reasonable understanding of China sanctions and how it impacts the worldwide supply chain. If we put all these three together, if a couple of these three start to play out, I think we should hopefully turn things around by late 2023, and predicting 2024 should be a growth year. Folks are already predicting 23 to be a down year by 5 to 7% in that range, but I'm hoping 24 will be a growth year again. So hope that answers a question as best as I can. So thank you.
Oh, I agree. I think 2024 will be an up year. I don't think that 2023 is going to be as bad as people say, but we'll see. Well, thank you, Sagar, for your time, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks, Daniel. This was a pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.